From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside, SF.
Coming up, San Francisco's soup kitchens are introducing healthier foods in their meals.
We had eggplant on the menu. And I got a comment from a guest. I'm not going to eat an egg that comes off a plant.
Then we'll get to know the community that gathers at Portsmouth Square in San Francisco's Chinatown.
This is a good meeting ground to meet new friends and family and a mix of stronger community.
And it's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's thousands of meteors shooting across the sky.
Of course, the beauty of the whole thing is the reaction. Is when a good one goes by, everyone just shouts and screams and yells. It's good fun.
Stories from San Francisco to the stratosphere today on Cross Currents. Soup kitchens in San Francisco's Tenderloin District feed thousands of homeless and low-income people every day. These free meal sites serve as a vital source of nourishment. For some, it's their only meal of the day. But a recent study suggests that these meals might not be that nutritious. A group of doctors and researchers from San Francisco General Hospital looked at six free meal sites across the city where lunch staples included turkey tetrazzini, fried chicken, and hamburgers. They found that a lot of what's offered lacks basic nutrients like vitamin A, vitamin E, and calcium. Soup kitchens know this is a problem, and some are trying to address it. KALW's Tiffany Kamhai went to the Tenderloin at lunchtime to see what two free meal sites are doing to make sure hungry people get healthy food.
At the corner of Taylor and Ellis Streets in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, the line for Glide Memorial Church is a block long. Glide's home to one of the city's oldest and best-known soup kitchens, feeding more than 2,000 people a day. Today, the church is expecting close to 600 people in what they call their dining room, just for lunch.
That looks good.
One of those people is Hannah Mariah. She's an energetic 65-year-old, wearing a blue jumpsuit and a fuzzy purple hat. She's been eating in this dining room for over 10 years. I find her sitting at one of the dozen or so round tables with her Chihuahua Terrier.
That's Chico.
Chico.
Yeah, and he's two.
Mariah lives nearby in the West Hotel. She eats at several free meal sites around the neighborhood. She likes to check a few menus each day. She says the food Glide serves is good, but she thinks they could do better.
I have a limited source of food, and I need to eat the best food possible. I don't need empty carbohydrates. I don't need fried food. They have a lot of fried food, a lot of carbohydrates.
On her lunch tray, she has a chicken patty sandwich, stewed carrots, macaroni and cheese, a ripe red plum, and a small cup of organic strawberry ice cream.
Instead of just one vegetable, I would like to see two vegetables, less starch, the fruit, which they always give, which is really good, and understand they're working with what they have. Okay, but the meat is not my favorite here. Chicken.
So the foods that are served in soup kitchens in San Francisco and at other free meal sites have too little fiber in them. Same with the typical American diet. They have too much fat in them. Same with the typical American diet.
Dr. Hillary Seligman is one of the researchers who conducted the recent study of the city's soup kitchens. She says unhealthy foods cause problems no matter where you're eating. They're linked to major health consequences like diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. But low-income and homeless people are at more risk just because of their environment.
What are you going to have? We have lamb, barbecue lamb, we have fish, and we have rigatoni. Rigatoni, can I get one more vegetarian, please? Right this way, ma'am.
Serving healthy food is one of the top priorities for Bruce McKinney, the program manager of Glide's free meals program. I met him in his office at Glide. McKinney says Glide is always working towards serving healthy foods. They partner with the San Francisco Food Bank to offer fresh produce every day, and they even hire an independent nutritionist to come in twice a year and analyze the menu. But sometimes they have to make choices. Healthier food costs more.
The food bank started offering us brown rice at 41 cents, something like that.
So not the 19 cents that we were paying for white rice.
So there's lentils and small white beans, and then red beans, garbanzo beans.
Just three blocks away from Glide is the St. Anthony Foundation. Their dining room serves about 2,500 lunches a day. I'm in the food storage room with program manager Charles Summer.
How fast do you like go through your product here?
This,
To me, this seems like so much, but...
No, nothing that you can see will be here longer than, at the most, 7 days, at most. But a lot of it will turn 2 or 3 days. We have these 100-pound bags of rice that we get. These at the bottom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
One meal for us when we serve rice is about 300 pounds. So that's maybe at most a week's worth of rice there.
Summer says cost is one barrier to serving healthy food. Another is more basic, what people are willing to eat.
I remember years ago when I started, we had eggplant on the menu. And I got a comment from a guest that said, I'm not going to eat an egg that comes off a plant. He literally believed that it was some sort of bizarre egg that grows on a plant.
You have the salad, the fruit, the bread, the entree. So yeah, it's balanced. I just like to see fried chicken. Once the money wouldn't hurt for a good old fried chicken, right?
Out in the dining room, I meet William Bailey. He's been coming here for 12 years. Bailey admits he eats for taste, not health.
Tofu is, what is tofu actually? I don't even know what it is.
Soy. It's a soy product. Yeah. It's a common meat substitute.
Exactly. Nothing substitutes meat.
The demand for meat is a big one. It's where most of the food budget goes at both St. Anthony's and Glide. Although they cut deals with local distributors, they say meat is still very expensive. And spending more money on one type of food leaves less for another. Here's Glide's Bruce McKinney again.
It's an ongoing, constant struggle. You know, constantly looking at the numbers, constantly going, oh my God, we just don't have enough money.
With more money, he says you would add variety to the meals and completely avoid things like hot dogs. St. Anthony's Charles Summers says his dining room has started serving more whole foods, stopped using margarine, and made other changes, like purposely undersalting the meals. But they still leave salt and pepper on the tables.
I often see folks just dumping salt. And sometimes that's hard to watch, and from a nutritional standpoint, you want to say, stop. But then I think about going out to a restaurant here in the city, and you see the exact same thing, and folks are making choices every day, whether they're aware of it or not, around food.
You can see choices being made at the tables. At St. Anthony's, people trade fruit for an extra pat of butter. And at Glide, many of the trays that go back to the dishwasher have uneaten salad, carrots, or fruit.
How you doing, Bruce?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm better.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
McKinney has grown to see the kitchen staff, volunteers, and dining room visitors as his family. He knows many of the people who eat at Glide by name, and he says he feels a responsibility to them.
This is their home. I believe that big time. You know, I go home and I have my days off. I get away. You know, there's that stark reality that while I was home, not thinking about work, the tenderloin was continuing. And the pain was continuing, and the hustle was continuing, and the worrying about where you're going to eat was continuing, and making sure you get up to Glide so you can either get a shelter reservation or whatever the reason, or simply get a meal, that never ended.
And while opinions on the food may change, people can always expect to find a hot meal in the tenderloin at lunchtime. In San Francisco, I'm Tiffany Kamhai for Cross Currents.
For photos and video of the Glide Dining Room in action, go to klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. A healthy meal can be essential to physical health, but it's also a conduit for community. Spaces where you can gather to eat or just chat and feel at home are hard to come by. In downtown San Francisco, there's one space that's long been claimed as a communal gathering place for the city's Chinese immigrants. It's called Portsmouth Square. During the gold rush, it was considered the busiest meeting place for the largely immigrant port community. Over 170 years later, the square is still a major focal point for residents of San Francisco's Chinatown and a place where new and old immigrants gather every day. KALW student reporter Marco Choi wanted to understand more about the significance this square holds for local Chinese history, so he went right to the site and brings us this audio postcard.
San Francisco's Chinatown has interested many tourists over the years. Every day, people visit to learn about Chinese-American history.
Kim Nemeca.
I'm a camp counselor here. So in Culture Day, we usually take them around a historical place in San Francisco, and we decide to come to Chinatown. Just all the history behind it, about how it started and how it became this tourist place, from being this refugee place for people going from a different country. So I want my kids to learn that.
That's not how I used to think about the square. The first time I came here, I thought it was so lousy. People gambled and screamed a lot. But after talking to people, I started to see things differently. For example, a lot of people sit together to gamble. A Chinese senior pointed out why.
This park is popular. A lot of people come here. The kids and seniors always come here because they've got nowhere to go. They think it is so boring to just stay at home. So they spend time at the park. They sit, gamble, and play cards. They use a quarter or a buck for gambling.
There are also seniors who like to listen to Chinese music and walk around the park.
I come every day, and I live in Chinatown. I just hang around here and walk in this park. There are plenty of Chinese people who come here every day, so we do not have the problems of communication. I like to listen to this music because I learned about singing when I was 15 years old. I think this park is peaceful and quiet.
The park brings back a lot of memories to the people who grew up in Chinatown. Like my family friend, Jeff Lee.
Hi, my name is Jeff Lee. In my childhood, all of my friends all grew up in Chinatown. So the place we would always hang out or congregate would be at the plaza, because the plaza was symbolic for young and old, from new generation to old generation. We'd play and the old folks would play cards and mahjong, and we'd have picnics and festivals.
Lee says when he was growing up, a lot of people met their new friends in the plaza.
We would come to the Portsmouth Square Plaza every day. So we know everybody. It's like a village. Everyone knows everybody. Everybody takes care of each other, and it's one happy family.
The plaza also has five statues. Each of them represents a different event. They are part of history, but they are also important to people in Chinatown today.
The most important part of the plaza is that the statue of the Chinese Liberty is erected there for the Chinese to recognize their worthiness, being new immigrants and continue migration of immigrants coming to San Francisco. That is the like the heartbeat.
For many people, this park is the heart of Chinatown.
So they meet old and new immigrants, and that's how people come together and realize that this is a good meeting ground to meet new friends and family, and it makes a stronger community.
This recording gave me a different impression of the square. It's not a lousy place only. It also represents the connection between groups of people. And it reminds me why my family came to San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I am Marco Choi.
That audio postcard was produced by Burton High School student reporter Marco Choi. You can find more stories from our Burton High School interns at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now we'll shift focus from our communal gathering places in San Francisco to the skies high above us. This weekend, over 100 meteors per hour will descend on Earth in the annual Perseid shower, otherwise known as the Fireball Champion. This shower contains the highest concentration of bright meteors, aka fireballs, which are known for leaving bright, visible streaks in the sky as they fall, more so than any other recurring meteor shower. San Francisco's urban astronomer Paul Salazar sat down with KALW's Ben Trefney to explain what you can expect to see in the night sky over this weekend.
The Earth is in this magical spot in its orbit around the sun where every year we encounter a stream of debris, and that creates a beautiful meteor shower which will be peeking out over the weekend and into early next week. It's called the Perseids meteor shower, and this weekend will be a fine time to see it for a number of reasons. It's a good shower. It brings a lot of meteors. It could be up to 50 to 100 per hour in a dark location. It's summer, so the weather generally is a little bit better, more pleasant for lying outside at night and enjoying something like this. And we have the good fortune that the moon is cooperating. The moon phase can make a big difference. If you have a bright full moon, that washes out the majority of the meteors. But with a very thin moon that will set soon after the sun sets, we'll have a very good view. With meteor showers, the best way to see them is to be in the darkest location you can find. Now, us city dwellers are trapped by the fact that we have a lot of city light that pollutes our night sky. But even so, there are dark spots you can go to, for example, the beach or the coast here in San Francisco. Even my own backyard, if you can get to a darkened spot. So you want to find the darkest spot, number one. Number two, let your eyes adapt. Spend a few minutes. Don't just walk outside and expect to see a brilliant number of shooting stars the instant you walk out. You have to be patient. And you have to be relaxed and just kick back on a chair or on the ground or on a sleeping bag or something. And eventually you'll start to notice them shooting around the sky. But ideally, if you can get somewhere where it is really much darker, you want to do that. So if you can travel a little bit north or east of the Bay Area, you'll get a better view. The mountains, of course, or north coast. I'm going to be up at Mount Tam. So Mount Tamalpais is a place where every month the San Francisco amateur astronomers have a star party. And rather conveniently, our star party this Saturday night will coincide with the early onset of the Perseids. And we're going to, quote-unquote, stay open late so the general public can come up there along with us. We're going to have a lecture, stargazing through telescopes, and then the meteors will start sprinkling around the sky as well. You know, we get pelted by meteors every night because all it takes is a little particle about the size of a grain of sand or a pebble to create a beautiful streak across the sky. They come in at tens of thousands of miles per hour, and at that speed they heat up, they light up, and they're so bright you can see them for 50, 100 miles around in a circle. But when you reach the meteor shower, the annual meteor showers, it's because we know at different points in the Earth's orbit we're going to encounter a lot more richness, and it's predictable. And again, after midnight, they only get better.
Well, what if one is the size of like a cable car? I mean, is it going to...
You don't want too many cable cars coming in. Those are dangerous. That's what happened last February. You might recall we had a big impact over Siberia. And something the size of a cable car or a school bus or, in that case, an Olympic swimming pool, something like that comes into the Earth's atmosphere. And not only if it hits the ground, it's really quite powerful, but even if it doesn't hit the ground, like in Russia, but explodes up in the sky, it's still releasing the force of many, many megatons equivalent. So it's not a good thing. We want the small ones. Little pebbles are good. some meteor showers actually do routinely bring in larger, if you will, stones and baseball size, and those create what are called fireballs, things that really are much brighter than every other object in the sky. But the Perseids are known for more of like a gentle rain shower. So you're going to get a lot of, I'll call them ordinary meteors. They light up the sky, but they're not super brilliant, but they're sufficiently bright that as long as you're relaxed and you're looking up and you're enjoying the view, you'll spot them, you know, every minute or two swinging by. It doesn't hurt to have a good eastern horizon for this one. But quite frankly, if you just lie on your back and you look straight up, that's the best view. At any given time of the night, whether you start at 10 o'clock at night or midnight, or you get up at 3 or 4 in the morning to watch it, just most important thing is you want to have a good, nice horizon. And also what I think is much more fun is to do this with a couple of friends, or a couple dozen friends, if you can find them. Like I'm going to be up in the mountain with a lot of the amateur astronomers and the members of the public that come up there. It's just, you know, more heads see more things. And even if you might miss one that's out of the corner of your eye, somebody else might spot it. And of course, the beauty of the whole thing is the reaction. Is when a good one goes by, everyone just shouts and screams and yells. It's good fun.
That was urban astronomer Paul Salazar in conversation with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find out how to join the San Francisco Amateur Astronomers for the Perseid Meteor Shower at our website. It's KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. All week long, we've been playing you this sound. We asked you what it is and where we recorded it. We got the idea for this sound from listener Bob Boynton, who wrote to tell us about a signature Bay Area sound you can only hear on a Wednesday around 11 a.m. KALW's Mary Reese traveled to Richmond to get to the bottom of what this sound means and the role it plays in people's lives.
Name's Tommy. That's T-O-M-M-I-E, Thomas. I live in Richmond Hilltop.
Please tell me where you were a year ago when the Chevron fire happened and what you did and how you knew what to do.
I was at home. And where I live at, there's a siren right on the pole, right close to my house. The reason why I knew something was going on, I was looking out of my kitchen window and I saw my neighbors on the street and they were looking up in the air. And I was wondering what's going on, so I came out the door, went out, went down. They pointed up, and I seen this big cloud coming over. And then I could see the refinery from my house. Then I knew it was a fire. But I didn't hear any siren. There wasn't any siren.
Even though you were right there next to it?
Right, because right now I'm retired. So when the thing comes on, a lot of times at home, all the dogs start barking, and I jump up myself just to look around, you know. So
how does it make you feel these days?
Nervous inside, because I don't really know what's going on. It's a bad sound. It makes you nervous.
Please tell me your name.
Oh, it's Teresa Gonzalez.
Do you remember where you were a year ago when the Chevron refinery fire happened?
I was at my house. My uncle called me. He texted my sisters, and everyone was like, don't go out, mostly because I have asthma, so they didn't want me to go out. But I usually hear it. The first time I heard it, I was like, whoa, what's going on? But then I started hearing it every Wednesday because I'm in independent studies, so every Wednesday I would go to school, and every time I would go to school, I would hear it. Someone I know, they told me, hey, what's that noise? I was like, oh, it's fine. It's Wednesday today. That's it just reminds me that it's Wednesday.
Could you imitate the alarm sound for me?
It's just like, let me see. It's really loud, but I'm not going to do the loud sound. It's just goes like, woo, and it goes on and on for a whole long time.
So you can't escape it?
No.
This past Tuesday was the one-year anniversary of the fire at Chevron's Richmond refinery. The city confirmed that not all emergency sirens went off that day, though the ones closest to the refinery did sound. Listener Bob Boynton, who suggested the sound, thought he'd stump everyone. But a lot of you got it right. Only one person can win, though. Congratulations to Zubair Ali. We're going to send you a KLW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there'll be another contest next week, and we love it when you give us ideas about new sounds to record. So visit KALW.org to tell us where we should go next and learn more about Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. That does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Holly McDeed, Daniel Moore, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. Jazz pianist Larry Vukovich gets called a lot of things, but he probably doesn't mind, since those things include consistently tasteful, richly varied, and deeply imaginative. Vukovich, who you're hearing right now, will be playing at the Trident in Sausalito on Thursday, August 15th at 6 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.